The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
The situation in Israel and the surrounding areas has been getting grimmer by the day as well. And we've seen Jews and Israeli Arabs now have turned on each other on the streets. There's even talk of that this could develop into a civil war. The pounding of Gaza, of course, continues. And you saw that media building being very dramatically knocked last night. Rocket attacks on Israel are ongoing. Joining me, rocket attacks on Israel. Joining me now from New York is award-winning writer Colm McCann. Good afternoon or good morning, Colm.
Good morning and good afternoon, I suppose. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you very much.
So listen, Colm, this is a part of the world that you've become to know very well and to try and, I guess, understand very well in the last few years. And you wrote about it through your most recent novel, A Paragon, and that delves into the Israeli-Palestine conflict, I suppose, through the eyes of two fathers from opposite sides who are two real people. Would you want to tell me first about Bassam and Rami?
Sure, yeah. I met Rami and Bassam 6 years ago when I walked into a little office in Beit Jala, which is just outside Jerusalem, and I met these two sort of extraordinary and also at the same time very ordinary men who sat down and told me the story about how they had lost their daughters in separate incidents. And Rami had lost his daughter to a suicide bomber in 1997. And Bassam had lost his daughter after founding an organization called Combatants for Peace. Afterwards, he lost his daughter to a rubber bullet in the back of the head shot from a very short distance. Against all odds, really, Brendan, the two men sort of use the force of their grief to try and say that we need to understand one another, and they travel around the world and tell the stories over and over and over again, and they're sort of extraordinary figures in the whole world of peace. Of course, they bring up all sorts of tensions within Israel and within Palestine itself, but they are I think they're men of a sort of courage that you don't really see, especially or you don't get a chance to see in a week like this. I mean, we've been seeing things for the past 7 days, and it's pretty devastating.
Yeah, you see, that's the thing. When you talk about those two men, and you get a sense of two men in the centre of things, but I suppose what we're seeing again this week more and more is people who are on the two extreme edges of things. What were your thoughts watching the news and all those images coming out of Israel and Palestine this week? I think a lot of people, even as inured as we can sometimes be to the Middle East and to things that happen far away, I think a lot of people are fairly shocked by it.
Oh yeah, everybody's shocked by it. The one thing that I think is important to say, that these are not just two men who are isolated. If you go to Israel and if you go to Palestine and you talk to some of the younger people who are there, and there's this creative energy, and there's this there's lots of like really, really wonderful things happening. They don't feel represented by Hamas. They don't feel represented in Israel by Netanyahu. There's a failure of leadership and a sort of moral abdication of responsibility on behalf of what I would feel was a majority of the people. And you're right, we're not inured to this. And the only sort of solace that one might be able to get from something like this is that, we've seen protests in the United States, and then people start to talk about it. People start to take stock, especially during the pandemic and even post-pandemic, people looking at these issues and sort of re-engaging with them, and hopefully, at a certain point, people will never be inured to what's going on. And, it'd be interesting to see what happens this afternoon when the United Nations meet and Simon Coveney gets to speak. And one would hope that the cooler heads could engage and start to talk about ways that we can repair all of this, because that's what it's about.
Yeah,
it's about human repair.
Yeah, but it seems to be that it's gone further now than it has in a while, hasn't it? And it'll be hard to take that back from the brink. Can I go back to something you said a minute ago, though? Because this is something that most of us probably don't have any impression of. Tell us, you've spent a lot of time there. Tell us about that vibrant culture and tell us about those young people and tell us about life there.
Oh, I would love to bring everybody, you know, into a little town called Beit Zahour, and to walk the little winding back streets and go to some of the cafes where there's some really interesting music going on, where young people are talking about philosophy and ideas and fashion and trends. And I went there actually about a year and a half ago with the Irish musician Colm McInumra, and we went to the Cafe Singer, the roof of the Cafe Singer, and Colm brought out his fiddle and played, and a lot of young people gathered around us, and it was a sort of medley of people together, and there was a great sense of vibrancy and cultural wealth and things that are going on, things that don't necessarily get represented by, you know, the events of this week, nor by, you know, mea culpa, by the media, we don't get a chance to see that there is a really nuanced culture going on there. We tend to get a sort of one-eyed look at what these people are, and I think that something might come, something might be emergent, something might come from underneath, from these times, especially if we're given access to those sort of stories. I like this principle of emergence, you know, where one bird is beautiful and does a lot of work on its own, but then a flock of birds has a deeper intelligence. I feel the same way about stories and storytelling. And the more that we tell the stories about these cultures, about these people, about what's truly going on in the background, the more chance you have at engaging with ideas of understanding and peace and so on.
Yeah, and you have a very simple kind of an idea, really, a notion, and it brings us back to Rami and Bassam, which is that by telling each other our stories, that's how we build empathy and understanding of each other.
Yeah, I mean, you're right, it's simple, but nothing's simple, especially trying to make it simple in the first place. That's the grand irony here. There's a great achievement in simplicity. And what Rami and Bassam say is, if we don't know each other above ground, we're going to end up knowing each other 6 feet below ground. And we do not want that for ourselves, nor for our children, nor for our grandchildren. And so when they say that we need to know each other, we need to know one another's stories, and not, well, I'm not talking about facts and figures and histories and all this sort of, although that's important, I will never deny the importance of that, but facts can be mercenary things, you know. Mm-hmm. They can be shipped off wherever you want them to go, and they can do lots of work for you that's not necessarily honorable work. But texture and stories and personal stories and issues of the heart, if you will, that's much more interesting, and it's not, doesn't become diseased with facts. So in certain ways, one of the things that we think, and certainly at my organization Narrative 4, we believe that stories are the democracy, and where we sort of can legislate the world. Some people say, well, they're right, I mean, scientists say the world is knit together with the, you know, quarks and molecules or atoms or whatever. But I think it's sort of knit together with stories in many ways. And we need to sort of be able to understand where we don't have to like somebody, we don't have to love somebody on the other side, quote unquote. But it is necessary to try to understand them if we're going to live next.
And how they got there. Yeah.
Exactly.
The thing is, but again, this week, it does feel, doesn't it, like that the extremes on either side own the story of the place, and that the, in a way as well, the rest of us are almost demanded to take a side. It can be presented in a very binary fashion, can't it?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the big disease that we have these days, I mean, whether it be in Israel, Palestine, whether it be in the United States or in Ireland, is the disease of certainty. You know, we're all so certain. I'm right, you're wrong. Yeah. If you don't look like me, and if you don't sound like me, don't come near me. And this is a real problem. I mean, what we really need to be able to embrace is some of the messiness, you know, and I hope some of the people who go along to the United Nations today are willing to say, you know, this is messy. This is complicated. This is confusing. You know, I don't have the absolute answer, but we need to work through the messiness and actually use the energy of the messiness to come to some sort of place where we can begin just only tiny, tiny, tiny steps to get a crack in the wall. Because eventually, you know, as Rami and Bassam say, eventually, you know, all those walls come tumbling down. It's a matter of speed and how we achieve the process of getting there.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but from your time spent there and maybe your insights as an outsider and everything, do you have any stabs at where the answer lies at all?
I mean, there's people a lot more intelligent than me who've been doing this for years and years and years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do believe that something will come through. I would love to see, you know, a young Greta, you know, come about in whether it be in, you know, the West Bank or in Gaza or in Israel itself, or maybe even in Ireland. You know, who knows where these answers can come from? But Greta Thunberg got up out of her classroom a few years ago, walked out, and eventually started a movement that had us all talking about climate change. Now, I think that sort of emergent stuff will work. There are a lot of good organizations. There are a lot of good people who are out there, you know, and one of the things that I think we have to keep doing, and thank you for inviting me on the show, is being able for us to talk about this. And so ultimately, if I had my druthers, I would say a lot of it's going to come through teachers. A lot of it's going to come from the education system and access to a sort of nuanced version of, say, Palestinian history, an access to nuanced version of where all of this actually stems from and where it might be going at the same time. And that people are not as one-dimensional as we want them to be.
And then I suppose you've done a novel that deals in the nuance of it in a sense, and it's a tricky line to walk, I'd say, especially as an outsider blundering in there. How have people received your novel in both of the traditions out there?
Yeah, I mean, I was scared. I went there and I said, you know, I met Rami and Bassam and I came back and I live in New York and I said, well, what can I do? I'm Irish, you know, I live in New York, and here I am. I'm going to embark on a novel about a place, you know, 4,000 miles away. And, you know, but part of being an outsider, which is absolutely correct, was the ability to say, I have no particular skin in the game. I'm not Israeli, I'm not Palestinian, I'm not Jewish, I'm not Muslim. I do come from a Christian background. However, I feel that I can get in there and have an ability to understand not just two sides, because there's so much more than two sides. That's why, you know, the word a paragon actually means a shape with a countably infinite number of sides. And I knew that stepping in there would be, you know, stepping into the hornet's nest in certain ways. I've been very, very lucky. Of course, I've had people take a good old whack at me every now and then from all sides. But you know what? I welcome criticism, and especially when it's healthy. A lot of the time I find, however, the people who criticize the book are the people who actually haven't read it, which is, you know, par for the course sometimes. But I have to say, I've gotten more letters in the past year than I have in the past 30 years of writing.
Really?
Especially from Yeah, oh gosh, it's really, really, really amazing. And it's hard to keep up with because these letters are laced with such emotion. And there's people out there dying to tell, well, I shouldn't say that, people out there who really want to tell their story and haven't, you know, got the proper outlet for it. And they're the ones who actually are the peacemakers and have something to say. Because there's so much in those letters about forgiveness, Brendan, and decency and trying to understand and not being represented and, you know, acting in civil society and keeping focus on the long term. And, you know, so it gives me heart that sort of stuff is absolutely there. It just doesn't get the play.
And Colm, have you been talking to friends out there in the last week?
Yeah, I mean, I had a friend who's a Palestinian citizen of Israel, lives in Jaffa, and, you know, he had his car burnt out. You know, they're talking about groups of people, you know, on the streets, you know, in these towns that, you know, where people live side by side for a long time, they're scared. They're really worried. They talk about, you know, seeing these things in history before in the 1920s and the 1930s. They talk about, you know, trying to get back with one another. How can they trust one another again when these sort of things have happened? They talk about looking for someone to come along and sort of make sense. You know, the Palestinian rap star Tamer Naffer was talking during the week. Oh, he's got an awful lot to say, and he's got an awful lot of weight on his shoulders, and his hometown is sort of burning up in certain ways, and you know, it'll take people like him who have the respect of the community to sort of calm things down. So it takes women. And in particular women and men of courage who are going to get out there peacefully, engage and set the table for people again.
Okay, let's whoosh across the world a bit to New York. Obviously, you're based in New York, and our sense here certainly was that New York was hit particularly badly with COVID and some awful scenes that we saw coming from there. What was your experience of it all?
You know, it's amazing. I think about it now. You know, we're in the middle of May, and this time a year ago, there were tents, white tents, in Central Park. There were refrigerated trucks sitting outside the hospitals, full of bodies. There was panic all about. You know, we weren't able to get masks. There were little moments, little glimmers of light when people at 7 o'clock in the evening would hang out the windows and, you know, bang their saucepans and cheer for all the health workers and stuff. But it was a dark, dark, dark time. And of course, the summer, there were protests in the summer. And how and ever, I've got to tell you, and somehow within the past 2 weeks, things have completely turned around.
So New York is irrepressible, isn't it? They can't keep it down. Yeah.
Well, that's it. But we hope that everywhere is irrepressible. I know Ireland's irrepressible. You know, things will come back. You should have seen that at Central Park yesterday. It was packed to capacity with people. And there's a real sense in the air that this is over. And we got to get on with our lives again. And I know that's going to happen at home too, because, well, I still think of Dublin as home. So
yeah. And is there great joy in the air at normality again? Yeah.
Yeah, you can sense it amongst the young people as well. Who knows what's going to happen? There could be some sort of like cultural, sexual revolution and all sorts of things could go on. But there is a sense in the air that we went through probably the very, very worst. And now it's time to take stock, hit the reset button. And one only hopes that the reset button gets hit by the right sort of people. That's the thing. But it does feel as if we're on the cusp of something new.
And Colm, you mentioned the charity you helped set up Narrative 4 earlier. You're also involved as a judge in a competition for young writers with another not-for-profit called You Think. Will you tell us about that?
Oh yeah, it's fantastic. It's a great opportunity for young people from the age of 13 to 18. YouthInc has set up a global short story competition, which is kind of fantastic. And you know, it had to come from Ireland, which is just, you know, that you know, where the short story is the real language, and literature is the language. But it's the winner of this competition, it's a 3,000 word short story, will get to go to a creative writing workshop in Kilkee Castle, and all expenses paid, and it's a kind of wonderful opportunity. And entries go, all those young people out there, you know, who are scribbling their stuff down right now, entries go until December the 31st of this year, and they can go to YouthInc on the web and figure out what's going on.
And it brings us right back to kind of where we were earlier, which is that young people all over the world telling each other their stories, and maybe that way we create a little bit more empathy. Okay, Colin McCann, thank you very much. Let's take a break.
Email brendan@rte.ie.